Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today are Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies and Pete Gerritsen, a retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and space power theorist who is an independent consultant, but also co-leads the space power, or I should say the new space power initiative at the American Foreign Policy Council. Pete, welcome to the program. And Todd, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Vago.
Good to be back.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage, and Bell, of course, sponsors this podcast. Both of you are very strong advocates for the Space Force, and it's now born. Pete, until recently, you were teaching at the Air Command and Staff College at Sunny Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. It's been an extraordinary period for space, right? We have the founding of the Space Force. We now have a crest, a logo, a motto, all of which is, extraordinarily timeless, right? I mean, there was a concern it would be hokey, but it's a design that would look as good in 1947 as it would in 1961, as it will in 2061. So that's good. The force just issued its capstone concept last month. Issued its space industrial base strategy and study. Pete, you were one of the editors of that work. The Air Force just issued $5 billion in space launch contracts between 2022 and 26. 60% to United Launch Alliance, 40% to SpaceX, and unfortunately, from their perspective, both Blue Origin and Northrop Grumman ended up losing on that. And then also for NASA, it's been an extraordinary winning streak for the space agency with the Demo 2 flight of Crew Dragon, both on launch and recovery, a big success. Starliner around the corner, a Mars launch in between that. Pete, start us off with the capstone document and what it means for the Space Force going forward.
So, I was really prepared to be disappointed in this document, but I find I'm pretty impressed with it. This document, the Space Force was able to get it out in less than 8 months after their founding. It's a major change and upgrade over what exists both in the previous Air Power Counter Space Doctrine from the Department of the Air Force and the Joint 3-14. There's a lot in it. The things that I particularly like about it is that it is a strategic level document that I think gets the larger context right. It is certainly what I think most of us were expecting, that it is sort of a primarily brown water downward looking document that is very focused on joint integration. But even for people who are very strong proponents of sort of the Blue Water School of Space Power looking out, there are enough hooks in this document and enough terrific context that it can be really built upon.
Todd, what's your sense of it? And how do you think it interfaces with the Air Force, given that General Goldfein, before he left, and I think General Brown, who's now the new Air Force Chief of Staff, is going to be sort of laying out the services operational concept, as we've seen from General Berger in the Marine Corps. Talk to us about the Space Force document and how it connects to the Air Power document that we're going to be seeing come out of the Air Force soon.
Yeah, so I agree with Pete that I think that this is a good document, a good contribution here to the department's overall doctrine. I think one of the most important things that this document does is it sets the taxonomy and defines things like the space domain and key terminology so that the Space Force and space operators can have more productive conversations across the joint force. I think that's something that has been a barrier in the past. And so I think this helps break down some of those walls. And also, I think what's striking about it is it talks about the space domain, space operations, and space power in the same kind of frameworks and in the same terms that we talk about all the other domains. And it does not shy away from terms like space power, whereas we kind of have in the past. But, you know, we've never shied away from talking about air power or maritime power or ground power, right? And so it's putting space into that same military context. And I think that's very valuable. Now, what's also needed and what this document talks about is you've got to have lower level doctrine documents that come out all the way down to the tactical level. And that's ongoing. And, you know, we'll see more of that starting to spin out over time. Some of it we're not going to see spin out because it will be classified. But I think this really sets the table going forward in a really good and productive way.
What do you think about the Air Force doctrine we're going to see and how this connects to it? And Pete would like to get your take as well.
I mean, you know, yes, it should connect to Air Force doctrine as well. We'll have to wait and see, you know, can't render judgment on that yet. But even more important is how it connects to, you know, what the Navy, the Army, and the Marine Corps are doing, because quite honestly, space is more tied to the other domains than to air. And that's a dirty little secret that people have not been willing to talk about. But some of the biggest users of space have always been the Navy and the Army. And so I think how it ties into the maritime and the land domains is going to be even more important than how it ties into the air domain. I'm not as worried about how space integrates with air, quite frankly, because it's already been tied there organizationally for decades. It's tying it in with the other domains, and especially thinking through what are some of the key missions in other domains where space can either be an enabler or the Space Force maybe should be the lead for some of those mission areas going forward.
Even though the other services are more than somewhat adamant about not contributing people or budget to the new Space Force. But Pete, give us your sense on how all of this is going to interconnect ultimately and how it should interconnect.
Absolutely. There are a lot of moving pieces. So first of all, I'd like to echo what Todd said about the importance of space being able to integrate with the other domains and, in fact, the other combatant commands. And I think this is where we're already seeing dividends coming from having some level of independence of the Space Force. So now as a independent actor, it's able to broker those agreements with the other major users on space and not sort of get buried under a single parent service. And I also agree with Todd that I'm not that worried about space and air integration. I think that the cultural forces are very strong. I think we're seeing both AFWIC and the Air University LeMay Doctrine Center playing an important role in facilitating that conversation. And then as far as like what's happening on the air power side, my understanding is that we really have, for the first time, probably among the most motivated chief of staffs of the Air Force, who has a background and interest in doctrine and actually wants to see the doctrine documents that they own revised. And we're lucky, I think, that the independence of the Space Force is provoking a bit of a crisis of identity for the Air Force to reimagine itself, which I think will be very positive because air power has been neglected for a long time. People don't realize how hollow and underfunded it is because of the illusion of the large pass-through for the,
right.
our intelligence activities. So I know that there is a strong effort underway right now at the direction of General Brown to relook at the most fundamental doctrine documents, and they have an entire infrastructure thinking about concepts and what they're calling emerging doctrine. And then both the Air Force and the Space Force collaborated on a fairly recent release of what they call Joint All Domain Operations, JADO,
right.
That sort of talks about that.
And I think everybody is very excited to see some of that intellectual thinking. Not that General Goldfein wasn't focused on it, but I think there is a lot of excitement with some of these concepts, especially, you know, given what we've seen, for example, from Commandant Berger and, you know, how hard the Army certainly has been, you know, and obviously there's no surprise that the Army works doctrine very, very hard. And I know that Mike Gilday is looking at these sort of integrated operational concepts as well as CNO. The one question, though, right, One of the yin and yang elements of space, though, has been that it is seen as a global, even though it began as a military domain and a military theater, right? I mean, the first thing to transit space was a V-2 weapon that was shot, you know, in wartime. And really was pioneered, and the rocketry, whether it was Sputnik or Vostok or, you know, any of them, were all military at the end of the day. There's also this sense that it is a more peaceful and benign environment, right? So what is the positive part of talking about space as a military domain? What's the potential negative part of it? Because the whole drive was that it is a military domain, but it is different from air, land, and sea in terms of the militarization we will see from it. Or is that just a quaint fiction and it's about time that we jettison that notion, for whichever one of you wants to grab that question?
I'm happy to jump on that first, but you know, I think there are still people, especially in the arms control community, that cringe when they hear things like space superiority, space dominance, space power. They're just not used to hearing those military terms combined with space. And I think in the broader international space community, there are a lot of people who still want to view it as a very passive, benign domain that's primarily focused on science, exploration, and commerce. And, you know, I think it's just inevitable that, you know, we have moved, you know, over time to an environment where space is for science, exploration, and commerce. It is a business domain. It is also a warfighting domain. That is just the reality of where we are. And I think, you know, Russia's behavior just in the past few months just exemplifies how, whether we want it to be a warfighting domain or not, it is, and Russia and China are pushing it more and more in that direction. And so it's, you know, we could wish this away and try to say, oh, we're going to keep space, you know, benign, you know, we're going to try to keep, you know, warfare from extending into space. Well, you know, our adversaries get a say in that, and they're making it very clear to us that they are going to extend, you know, the battle space out into orbit. So, you know, the question then is, how do we respond and how do we get this back to a stable equilibrium that's to our strategic advantage economically and in terms of security? And, you know, like in other domains, the best way to secure the peace is by having a credible deterrent and showing folks that it is not worth the cost to you and it is not worth the benefits to attack us in space. So we've got to have some degree of overmatch there if we, you know, want to prevent or minimize the risk of conflict in space. And I think that's what this is all about. That's, you know, why, you know, we've got the space doctrine, this capstone publication. That's why all of this work is going into thinking through concepts of operations in space. It's in order to keep the peace.
So I'll amplify some of those points. So I agree that, you know, we have an invested degree of talking points from the arms control community that, and I think their motives are, you know, laudable and benign. You know, they would like to see space sort of be this example of how we could behave. And they have a history of sort of wrapping space up principally over nuclear concerns and escalation concerns that, you know, while those have not gone away, I just don't think that's sort of the center of where policy and strategy needs to go. And so, you know, in my view, you know, it isn't really appropriate to label, you know, space as just one aspect of human activity. It's a strategic domain where all these things, all elements of national power work. And certainly the United States has benefited in terms of public diplomacy, ideational, inspirational, by doing great feats that advance, peaceful and benign aspects. And it has also improved our collective security, through, you know, providing overhead reconnaissance that let us know exactly the potential for aggression or, you know, force structure. But the reality is that as a strategic domain that becomes ever more important economically, probably, you know, the better analogy isn't the high ground or the higher, faster, you know, version of air power. It's to see space fundamentally more like to a maritime domain. And just like naval forces, you know, carry out security and presence missions that enable commerce, and also when called upon, will protect access or conduct strike. In the same way, the Space Force is going to have a greater naval-like evolution. And, you know, I'll just throw in at this point, you know, that's another important reason why the Space Force officers should have naval rank.
I was going to try to see if we could get away from that lightning rod issue, but I completely understand. And you're making this case as somebody who spent 25 years wearing a U.S. Air Force uniform. So I know how you mean it. And I know others who are involved in the debate and the discussion who do see it in very, very similar terms. Let me take this to the moon. Pete, you're one of the people who believes that this space doctrine and our space approach, as you would say, sort of blue water space, right? Brown water space being something that's in Earth orbit, blue water space being something outside of Earth orbit. There are those who comically always point out that one of the reasons the president backed this was that he was convinced by Newt Gingrich and others that a space force would be necessary to protect mining colonies on the moon. Putting aside whatever humorous element to that there might be, what's the case you're making that this theater needs to extend to the moon and then beyond? Because there is a sense that the moon, however you want to put it, is much more of an Antarctic-like space, right? Nobody owns it. It belongs to everybody. Let's certainly not militarize it, you know, even if we do try to find commercial benefit from it, as limited as it may be.
All right, so I think this really gets to the fundamentals of your assumption about the future and what's possible. And so, you know, I had the great fortune to spend an awful lot of time in my military career really interacting with the far future and thinking about what's possible. So this is how I come at it. I come at it from some fundamental assumptions. The first is that if you look at power on planet Earth, the most powerful states are the most powerful in their militaries because they can afford it economically. And right now, the United States is in a position where other powers, specifically China, are increasing in their industrial capacity and wealth relative to the United States. If that continues, we end up in a position similar to the Soviet Union, where we are having to spend more and more on our defense to get less and less out of it. Now, if you look at where is potential wealth that could keep the United States as the premier economic power, one of the things that I think becomes obvious is that most of the wealth around us isn't on Earth. You have literally quadrillions of dollars worth of effective resources, you know, trillions of dollars worth of, you know, energy free for the taking that are outside of our biosphere. And it's just a matter of human ingenuity to go and get it. So in my view, while everything we're doing in the orbital regime of GEO and below is vitally important and really should be commanding the majority of our resources, we have to start now to put in intellectual resources and planning resources into thinking about a spacefaring society. Now, that's not just coming from me. You know, if you look at what are the ambitions of our titans of industry, of Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, most of the new space folks, and our adversaries, China, that's what they foresee. They foresee this eighth continent of the moon as making a meaningful contribution of one day, circa 2050, returning on the order of $10 trillion, and of enabling just vast new expansion of offer of energy and manufacturing. Now, that might seem crazy some, but what I would posit the analogy is that, you know, when the European powers were fighting over a limited pie on the continent of Europe, you could think about navies in terms of moving ships around and coastal waters. But the minute one of those nations started building ocean-going ships to start tiny colonies on the New World, that's a new game. And it's a new game not because of the military power it conveys initially, but because of its potential long-term economic power. And if you want that, like if that's a future that America wants and it's a future I want, then there are two important things to come out of it. One is that military research and development have always played a role in opening domains, whether it be the Transcontinental Railroad, the Eisenhower Highway, the TF-39 engine or the Liberty engine, for the C-5 or even in World War I, the internet, there is a role.
Undersea warfare.
Undersea as opening. Well.
Yeah.
Although we haven't really seen, undersea commerce, explode in the way some of these other domains have, but certainly the steamship, for instance, it was just hugely important, right? So there's this role that military research can do to create dual-use infrastructure and extend commercial power. The second is that commerce by itself, if you leave it to its own devices, either has to look for self-help or it is subject to some form of coercion. And you can imagine that a treaty, could say, that says important things might protect you. But particularly when it comes to the behavior of the People's Republic of China and the South China Sea, I don't think that their behavior has been trustworthy enough that we can think that they would act in a wholly benign and open manner towards commerce as it develops. And so in that sense, I see less about warfare and more about the ability to counter coercion, to enable free commerce and to counter what would be constriction to that future commerce in the space domain.
Todd?
So, yeah, I think this is where I, do respectfully disagree with Pete a bit, not entirely. Maybe I'm just from a different school of thought when it comes to space power. But for me, cislunar space, mining on the moon, near Earth asteroids, there's a lot of potential there, but it is not yet clear to me that that's going to be economically viable to get those materials, either bring them back to Earth or use them for other operations in space. I don't think we know yet, but I think there certainly is a role for government in helping go out and fund some of that science and exploration through NASA to see if it's possible, and if it is, to make it so. And so there is certainly the potential, but I don't know that it's really going to happen. I certainly have no confidence in the timelines of whether it'll be 10 years, 20 years, or 50 years before any of this becomes substantial. I will say this, though, that, there's going to be activity, out beyond just Earth-centered orbits, out into cislunar space, out to the moon and beyond. And as long as there is activity there, there's going to be a need for infrastructure. And like Pete was talking about, the military has in the past provided some of that infrastructure. That puts us in a good strategic position to know what's going on and to be able to set the rules of the road and norms of behavior if we are providing the infrastructure that others rely on. Just like the U.S. military provides GPS, which is the gold standard for PNT on Earth. Maybe we want the U.S. military to be providing that gold standard PNT all throughout cislunar space. I think that, those kind of questions we need to walk through and think about, okay, is this worth the investment? Does it put us at a good strategic position down the road? And I think particularly looking at PNT, comms, and space situational awareness or space domain awareness. I think those are good roles where the military may want to start extending its capabilities further out into cislunar space, but then provide it as infrastructure for others to use freely. And so, that's kind of how I look at this, is let's just set the table. So in case something materializes here in the future, in case this becomes, something important economically, that we're in a good position for that.
Obviously, there's a lot here for us to discuss in the future, and I'm happy to have a deeper conversation about that. I think that there is a very powerful case to be made that, hey, look, let's not militarize this any more than we need to militarize this, ultimately. And I think both of you know me well enough to know that I'm not Pollyanna when it comes to either arms control agreements or anything else, but sort of be very, very cognizant what you're getting into and what the stakes are. Because I'm a fan of Space Force, at least the TV show. I want another season. I'm interested to find out how the brawl ended up being resolved and who doesn't think that Steve Carell, John Malkovich, and of course Lisa Kudrow just absolutely were, I thought, terrific in the show, did build up a lot of momentum. Be that as it may, and I'm happy to get your views just before we end this podcast. Pete, talk to us a little bit about the industrial base study. Again, you were one of the editors of that. We just had a sequence of national security space launch contracts. Walk us through the industrial base study and how this these awards support that strategy.
All right. So first of all, I thought it was just shy of miraculous that a study as far-reaching as the Space Industrial Base 2020 study made it through not one but three different public affairs shops in the Space Force, DIU, and Air Force Research Lab, and for the first time discusses space transportation and logistics, space resources, in-space power, nuclear power. It really is a future-focused document. It certainly recognizes the importance of partnerships. I think, the awards are not a surprise. I think, what's driving the increased cost on the SpaceX side is probably a need to expand the number of payloads that the Air Force and NRO are able to do via vertical integration. I think that, the strategy tries hard to help and secure an industrial base where we have, even with, rockets that do occasionally fail, like Rocket Lab's last launch, you want to have multiple suppliers. I'm confident that if the money was there, the Air Force would want to have more providers, the Department of the Air Force would want to have more providers. But probably they are cost constrained. And certainly it would have been to our benefit to have three launch providers as suggested by both the FAST space study and the RAND study. And it would be, and it will be to our benefit, whatever happens with these specific research and development LSAs and the subsequent legislation in both the House and the Senate side for follow-on to keep maturing these capabilities, because they're, something, for instance, as disruptive as Starship, really, I think, ought to be in the mix as far as what we are helping develop.
Todd?
Yeah, I mean, I think the launch contract that was awarded, it's very consequential, although the result is not too surprising. Let's look at this. ULA and SpaceX were really the incumbents. And so it's not a huge surprise that they're the two that won. It is interesting, though, that what ULA was bidding is not an incumbent launch vehicle. Only SpaceX was bidding a vehicle that's flown of all the four companies competing. ULA, now the focus is on them, actually getting the Vulcan rocket up and running so they can start launching in just 2 years. But, like Pete said, I think we're going to look back at this, and I think that the Space Force is going to regret the acquisition strategy in the long run of intentionally narrowing it down to two companies at this point. I don't think it was necessary to do that. I think Blue Origin is going to continue development. They're going to stay in the game. Now they have essentially been locked out for 5 years. So I think the Space Force is going to have to come back and look at that and say, oh, actually, maybe they have some capabilities that we want to be able to tap into and look at modifying this down the road, if things start to play out like we expect they will. In terms of Northrop Grumman and the Omega rocket, you know, it doesn't look good if they don't have a government customer for that launch vehicle. I don't think they have said officially one way or another whether or not they're going to continue development, but it would not surprise me at this point if they say, hey, we're not going ahead with this, if the, you know, Space Force is not going to be a customer. But, you know, I think that this acquisition strategy was a holdover from, you know, the Air Force SMC type thinking about space acquisitions, where the government is the central customer, and they're going to need to transition to a different acquisition mindset, where you have to realize when it comes for things like space launch, communications, imagery, and lots of other things, that the government is not always the central customer, and that you're buying in a larger marketplace, and that you're going to need to buy things as a service where you're one of many customers acquiring that service.
DIU is doing that, by the way. You know, DIU has already done one launch commercially procured, yep. And I believe they have a total of 7 more launches on contract for sort of a 450 to 1,200 kilogram payload range.
And that thinking is starting to spread, but it has not quite permeated all of the acquisition organizations yet.
I agree. It's too early to neck down. We have 2 minutes left. You each get 1 minute. Pete, talk to us about the long-range manned space flight plan. Obviously, where we are with manned space flight is the benefit of a strategy that the last administration did. We supported, we funded it. We're now having some successes. And I should note, right, that a lot of these plans did begin under the Bush administration that was really looking for a transformation in space launch. There are things Obama administration did well and some things less well. And obviously, you know, then we, but obviously this administration is looking at its plan. Give me a very, very quick update on where we are over the long term and what it means. And then Todd, if you could jump in, less talking about this administration's plan, but we're also in a presidential race, what the Team Biden and Harris are proposing as well, so that we have some sense on what the opposition space plan, if you will, is, even though Vice President Biden was very much involved in the last, you know, in the Obama administration strategy. Go ahead, Pete, start us off very briefly, and then Todd.
Absolutely. So, you know, first of all, you know, we are, after a very long time, launching Americans on American rockets from American soil. That's very exciting. It showcases the, you know, not just SpaceX, but across the board, sort of a, you know, going from not producing American rockets to having a very robust rocket industrial base. That manned access to LEO takes place in a much broader emerging consensus about where we need to go. The White House has recently released Deep Space Strategy, lays out a very common sense idea of where the nation could go that I think major elements of that ought to be able to survive through multiple administrations. They, to their credit, in a very, you know, nonpartisan manner. I, you know, in my personal view, from a national power perspective, the focus on the moon as a target for industry is the right focus of our civil space efforts. And so it was very exciting to see industrialization and resources so prominently put in that document. And I will just, you know, turning it over to Todd, I really hope that if we do see a change in administration, that the subsequent vice president will be protective enough of her own power through the National Space Council, you know, that she would keep that as the central body for formulating interagency U.S. policy.
Yeah, and so, you know, I would just add that, you know, looking at a potential change in administration, there is a rich history of a new administration coming in and deciding to completely change the focus when it comes to NASA and space exploration. And, you know, there's a lot of history as well of Democratic administrations not paying a lot of attention to space policy issues. I think we, whether you love or hate the Trump administration, I think you have to give them credit that when it comes to space policy issues, they've made a lot of smart decisions and they've done a lot of good work. I think reestablishing the National Space Council turned out to be a very good decision, and the Space Council has done a lot of good work. And so hopefully, you know, a new administration coming in won't roll that back and won't dismantle those things. And the thing I'm most closely watching is I hope they don't redirect NASA like the Obama administration did coming into office. I hope they can keep the focus on the Artemis program, going back to the moon, adjust the timeline if you want to, but not by much. You know, you got to keep the fire lit under people to make things happen. But, you know, and a whole host of issues that the Space Council has been pushing as well on regulatory reform and commercial space, on pushing, you know, the DOD to more resilient space architectures, things like the Space Development Agency is working on. Hopefully, you know, a lot of good seeds have been planted, and I would just hope that a new administration coming in, they don't till up a lot of these seeds without really looking at the good that has been started.
Guys, thanks very much. Really appreciate it. Would love to have you back, especially for the deeper conversation on space commerce and what that all looks like. Thanks so very much for joining us.
Thanks, Vago.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.